Different people heard different things in the president's inaugural address. Some heard soaring rhetoric, inspiring togetherness and unity. For others, it was a sharply edged partisan speech. What did you hear? This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In his speech, President Obama highlighted the issues of gay rights, income equality, climate change, gun control, and immigration. This hour, we'll break down the speech and talk about the goals that might be politically possible. Our analysts this week, Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa, Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa. What surprised you about the inaugural address? Do you like what you heard? Was anything missing? Join us this Politics Wednesday after the news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. A side note to begin, we're aware of the problems we're having with the NPR news and are working on getting those fixed. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, and it's Politics Wednesday. A lot of politics to delve into and analyze with our guests this week. Tim Hagel, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa in our Iowa City studio. Hi, Tim.
Hey there.
And Donna Hoffman in Cedar Falls in our studio there, Chair of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. Donna, great to have you with us.
Hi, Ben. Great to be here.
We want to spend at least the first half hour talking about the inauguration, mostly the speech. Let's get right to it. We want also interaction with our listeners this hour, 1-866-780-9100. Different people heard different things in the president's inaugural address. Some heard soaring rhetoric, inspiring togetherness and unity. For others, it was a sharply edged partisan speech. This is in President Obama's speech, he highlighted the issues of gay rights, income inequality, climate change, immigration. So we want to break down the speech this hour, talk about the goals that might be politically possible. The speech was on Monday. We're going to spend the time talking about some of the issues raised specifically. But first, to the overall tone of the speech, Tim and Donna, many have called it partisan, lacking in the kind of soaring rhetoric meant to unify the country. The president talked about the nation's founding principles, and in this excerpt said that Americans recognize that preserving individual freedoms ultimately requires collective action.
For the American people can no more meet the demands of today's world by acting alone than American soldiers could have met the forces of fascism or communism with muskets and militias. No single person can train all the math and science teachers we'll need to equip our children for the future, or build the roads and networks and research labs that will bring new jobs and businesses to our shores. Now, more than ever, we must do these things together as one nation and one people.
President Obama on Monday in his second inaugural address. River to River listeners, what did you hear in that speech? What surprised you about it? What did you like that you heard? Was anything missing? Perhaps you didn't like something in there. Tell us about that. 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org, our email. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Reaction to the speech, not surprisingly, was mixed. Here's Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, who was not impressed.
Well, I think the president's inaugural address was disappointing in the sense that it was basically a liberal agenda directed at an America that we still believe is center-right. And I don't think that's a great way to start off a second term if your idea here is to achieve bipartisan solutions. And second, I think it was quite disturbing the short shrift given to the transcendent issue of our era, spending and debt.
Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. Tim Hagel, let me start with you. What did you hear in the speech? We're hearing analysts say everything from all that was mainstream, reflecting America, to Mitch McConnell, the return to liberalism.
Yeah, it's. I know we use the phrase, you know, what did you hear in the speech? I think everybody pretty much heard the same thing. It's whether they liked what they heard or not is the problem here. And in some respect, it was more partisan than you might have expected in an inaugural speech, particularly after a hard-fought election that maybe 2 months on, after people have had a little bit of time to calm down, you might have expected, again, a little bit more of the, you know, let's come together and work together, and as you mentioned, the bipartisanship. On the other hand, he's talking to, in particular, his base, the folks that got him elected that worked very hard, especially with the turnout machine. So it's not surprising that he was willing to go ahead and name check at least a number of issues that he may at least want to have on his agenda for the second term.
Donna Hoffman, for years, conservatives have called President Obama a leftist radical, if you will, hiding behind a moderate facade, perhaps a pragmatist there at best. If the country had only listened, this argument goes, voters would never have elected him in the first place. Now we're hearing conservatives say, "We told you so." Are they right? Is this signaling what President Obama would wish to be the dawn of a new liberal era?
I don't know that I'd go that far, but, you know, certainly what Obama does in this speech is indicative of, you know, one aspect of American political culture and American history. And there's this individualism strain that we, you know, we work hard, the American dream. There's also this notion of collective action, community, communitarianism, if you will, that also has a thread that runs through American history. And he's weaving both of those together, which may be part of why people are taking different things from this speech. Now, anytime you have a speech like this, it's always going to be filtered through the lens of whether you like the person, you know, your history with that person, et cetera. But, you know, Obama's trying to bridge this. He talks about, you know, for example, you know, we discovered that a free market, which is something, you know, about individualism, only thrives when there are rules that ensure competition and fair play. He's really, you know, blending these two traditions within the American political history, which, you know, gives somebody to, you know, everybody something to cling on to in terms of how they're going to perceive this particular speech.
Mm-hmm. Tim Hagel, what do you think this speech signals in President Obama's approach to Congress, to the majority in the House, the GOP majority in the House specifically?
Well, some have argued that Obama may be less interested in actually trying to secure his legacy. He may, to some extent, already have that with Obamacare, and you know, we'll see what happens with a few other things. And that what he'd like to do is continue to weaken, if not, I'll just leave it at continue to weaken the Republican Party, and maybe even his hope of hopes, try to get a Republican majority in the House in the 2014 elections.
Weakening them by through what means?
By dividing them in various ways. Trying to get, for example, with the fiscal deal that was cut today, I haven't seen what the final vote was, but I assume it passed, that the conservatives, the real fiscal conservatives that would say, all right, let's go ahead and go for broke kind of a thing, and let's, you know, not raise the debt ceiling and let the chips fall where they may, as opposed to the more practical folks, sometimes referred to the establishment folks, willing to take a more practical aspect to it, both in terms of saying, well, we can't do this, but also in terms of saying politically we can't do this because it will be more do us more harm than good. And so that kind of fracture within the GOP is something that certainly Obama and Democrats would like to encourage, so to speak, to sort of weaken the GOP for the next set of elections. It's hard to say whether that strategy will actually work, but at least the way things stand right now, it is an impediment to Obama achieving a number of points on his agenda.
You agree with that, Donna Hoffman? A goal here to weaken the GOP party, fracture it more?
Well, I think one of the things that you see if you look at Obama's speech in 2009 compared to this one, you know, he kind of tried that bipartisan approach in the first term and got criticized pretty roundly for it. You know, his base didn't like that. And so I think you see less of that in the speech. Now, you know, it is the case that Obama has to work with the Republican House. It is controlled by the Republicans. And so, you know, there is kind of a fine line, and there's a lot of strategy that goes into how the White House is going to deal with Republicans in the House and vice versa. And I think that's still being worked out in terms of how that's going to play out on the various policy issues. I think we'll see some where they can work together and some where they're not going to be able to at all.
If you just joined us, this is Politics Wednesday on River to River. Donna Hoffman, Chair of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. Tim Hagel, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa, invite you as we talk in this first half hour about the inauguration speech, what it signals for Obama's second term. Tell us, did you have a phrase that you especially liked in that speech or disliked? 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook or tweet us at IPR Talk. Let's talk about a few parts of the speech now. Listen to a couple of extended excerpts where the president laid out a vision on specific issues. Now, climate change was mentioned. Let's listen to what the president had to say about that.
We, the people, still believe that our obligations as Americans are not just to ourselves, but to all posterity. We will respond to the threat of climate change, knowing that the failure to do so would betray our children and future generations. Some may still deny the overwhelming judgment of science, but none can avoid the devastating impact of raging fires and crippling drought and more powerful storms. The path towards sustainable energy sources will be long and sometimes difficult. But America cannot resist this transition. We must lead it. We cannot cede to other nations the technology that will power new jobs and new industries. We must claim its promise. That's how we will maintain our economic vitality and our national treasure. Our forests and waterways, our croplands and snow-capped peaks. That is how we will preserve our planet, commanded to our care by God.
President Obama on Monday. Donna Hoffman, are you surprised that in this 18-minute speech, President Obama dedicated over a minute of it to climate change?
Not particularly. I mean, I think that's always been something that he has looked to. If we look at the first term, you know, we had multiple initiatives for alternative energy. And, you know, they certainly attempted cap and trade, although that didn't work. But I think this has always been something that, you know, maybe not a top priority of Obama, but has always been something that Obama has wanted to pursue. And, you know, giving some attention in this particular speech to that does signal something. Now, you know, what is obviously important going forward is what Obama chooses to put into the State of the Union address in a couple of weeks, because there you get much more concrete, specific policy agenda items where the president puts those forward to Congress. And so we'll see, you know, this rhetoric that he uses here that you played is very broad. We don't know specifically what he wants to do, and we'll get more specifics on that in a State of the Union address. So it'll be interesting to see how if he chooses to carry that forward in that address, which I would guess that he would, and then how much time he spends on it there, and then how much detail we get.
Mm-hmm. Tim Hagel, interesting, is it not, that if the fight against global warming will be a dominant theme in his second term, not a dominant theme in his reelection campaign?
Yeah, now be careful. You can't say global warming. You have to say climate change now, especially when half the country's in a deep freeze at this particular point.
Okay.
You'll get some jokes on that. Yeah, it's one of those odd things where obviously the campaign dealt a lot more with fiscal sorts of things, and of course the one of the main thrusts of the Obama campaign was to basically characterize Romney as an out of touch rich guy, which they did fairly successfully. Plus, of course, talking about some of the specific issues to try to get certain groups out to the polls, and they did so successfully. Climate change isn't one of those groups beyond perhaps a fairly small segment of the population that really motivates voters. So it's no surprise that it wasn't a big theme. But of course, it did get talked about in various places, and obviously came up, you know, coming here to Iowa talking about wind energy. So you get into the sustainable energy sorts of issues. But you know, I agree with Donna that to the extent that Obama does want to push this, that we'll probably see some of the more detailed sorts of things in the State of the Union, and where that's really not the place in an inaugural address to bring up those kinds of things. And in fact, a lot of the stuff that Obama talked about are things that, in a just sort of general sense, even Republicans and conservatives would agree with. But the problem for them is always that they sort of know the backstory. So when you talk about green energy or something like that, the first thing that would come to their mind is, Solyndra and the failure there. And so they're reading, you have a different take on what he's saying.
Let's go to Tom in Des Moines. He dialed 1-866-780-9100. Tom, I believe you had a point to make about the climate change comments by the president.
Yes, I was very excited to hear what he had to say about climate change. And I would defend it as belonging in the inaugural address, because it is a fundamental task of government right now to deal with climate change. This is a more important problem than we've seen attended to by the political parties and certainly by the president. So even though I think it's kind of a sop to environmentalists, I'm glad that he mentioned it, and I hope it's a precursor of more attention in the second term.
Okay. Tom, were you been disappointed in Obama's first term, the lack of attention to this topic?
Well, certainly. I mean, he's the educator-in-chief, and he has not done the job in terms of educating people about climate change. All the polls tell you that the American people are ripe for the picking on this. Once they understand the science, then they are convinced that we need to make collective action, to take collective action on this. But apparently the president hasn't gotten the message yet.
Okay, Tom, thank you for your views from Des Moines, 1-866-780-9100. The president also, in his inaugural address, second inaugural address, lumped several issues under the umbrella of human rights. Let's listen to this extended clip.
We, the people, declare today that the most evident of truths, that all of us are created equal, is the star that guides us still. Just as it guided our forebears through Seneca Falls and Selma and Stonewall, just as it guided all those men and women, sung and unsung, who left footprints along this great mall, to hear a preacher say that we cannot walk alone, to hear a king proclaim that our individual freedom is inextricably bound to the freedom of every soul on earth. It is now our generation's task to carry on what those pioneers began. For our journey is not complete until our wives, our mothers, and daughters can earn a living equal to their efforts. Our journey is not complete until our gay brothers and sisters are treated like anyone else under the law. For if we are truly created equal, then surely the love we commit to one another must be equal as well. Our journey is not complete until no citizen is forced to wait for hours to exercise the right to vote. Our journey is not complete until we find a better way to welcome the striving, hopeful immigrants who still see America as a land of opportunity, until bright young students and engineers are enlisted in our workforce rather than expelled from our country.
President Obama on his second inaugural speech on Monday. Donna Hoffman, we heard several issues mentioned there, references to equal pay, same-sex marriage, immigration reform. What is your take on that, that actual portion of the speech?
You know, I think that's where you find maybe some of the most soaring rhetoric that you find in the speech. I mean, it's toward the end of the speech, as I recall, and Obama has really, you know, kind of geared up and is really, you know, pushing these issues of human rights, which includes, you know, he mentions, and I think one of the things that's often quoted from this speech now and going forward is the Seneca Falls, Selma, Stonewall. There's been a lot of comment on the inclusion of Stonewall in that particular aspect and specific reference to gay and lesbian rights. And so, you know, he wraps the right to vote is in there, immigration reform. He wraps those up kind of in the whole, you know, in this ball of things that, you know, we as a nation should move forward on because we always have. It's part of this, you know, drawing upon shared experience of the country, shared values, and trying to put those then into some concrete ways in which we can move specific things forward.
Mm-hmm. Remind us, what is the reference to Stonewall?
It was a riot, essentially, in a gay bar in New York City that really was a reaction to some police overstretch, some police brutality. And so it really is usually seen as kind of a moment that that crystallizes the LGBT movement as a movement, more or less. It was kind of a coalescing event for that community.
Mm-hmm. This president making history here, did he not, Tim Hagel, with references to gay rights?
Yeah, both in terms of talking about gay rights specifically and Stonewall, that people attach a fair amount of significance to when a president says something that's sort of some new sort of thing or makes reference to something in that of that nature in sort of a high-profile event like this. I can recall that there was a great amount of consternation among many when Reagan did not say the word AIDS in public for a long, long time. And then when he finally did and sort of recognized that this was out there and had to begin to confront that particular issue in the 80s. And so it's important in terms of symbolizing a recognition of some right or some interest or some problem or whatever it happens to be. But of course, what's more important is what happens afterwards, if anything.
Mm-hmm. What about the style of the speech? I think you alluded to this, Donna Hoffman. This is toward the end of the 18-minute speech here. Am I mistaken in saying that at some moments he seemed to be trying to channel Martin Luther King Jr. on Martin Luther King Jr. Day?
I think in that clip you really do kind of hear it. You know, there's kind of that I don't know that lilt sometimes that he gets when he's really on a roll and linking things together, and I think you see that there. And certainly he has a reference to Martin Luther King,
the King,
right? A King,
mm-hmm. King or the King, yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. And you know, if you read the transcript, that's capitalized. It's clear that he's referring to Martin Luther King Jr. there on that day. He refers to the people who walked on the mall. That's a reference there too. And so there's a lot of symbolism. There's a lot of things in this speech that Obama, you know, gets at kind of rather obliquely, and you know, those references in that particular passage that we heard is where you hear some of that.
How would you rank this, Donna, and then Tim, on a scale with other inaugural speeches? One of the better ones?
You know, that's really hard to do at this point because that really takes some reflection. And, you know, one of the things about this particular speech, and this is true of a lot of presidential speeches in general, is you can give a really great speech in terms of diction, in terms of imagery, in terms of those kinds of things. But whether people remember that speech is really going to be we're going to want to see what happens after it. You know, is Obama able to do these things? Are they going to really address climate change? You know, if they don't, then the speech falls flat and the speech becomes something that we don't really remember, even if there is some soaring rhetoric in there. It's when, you know, you have a reference and then that thing gets carried through on and you can see a connection, you can see the results. Mm-hmm. And that really colors whether the speech is memorable or not is really what comes after.
Tim Hagel, much the same point that you were making there. Not much talk about the world outside of the U.S. in this speech. No talk of some new direction for America's role in the world. A couple of lines signaling that President Obama wants to end an era of perpetual war, as he said, and that projecting American influence requires not just a force of arms, but also strong alliances and rule of law. No surprises here. Before we go to the break, foreign policy. Tim Hagel, did you hear anything there?
Well, that was never his strong suit. It was always the domestic policy where he was on more comfortable ground, and that's basically what the focus of his campaign was and basically things that he had not done in his first term that he wants to get back on the agenda. So, you know, certainly he's aware of foreign policy sorts of things. And, of course, we had the Benghazi hearings this morning with Secretary of State Hillary Clinton testifying. And so in some sense, it's not surprising that he probably didn't emphasize that area as much as he did domestic policies.
It has, though, defined his first term, though,
much to his consternation.
We have to take a short break. I'm glad you mentioned Benghazi. When we come back, we'll talk about that. Earlier today, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton talking to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee about Benghazi, that long-awaited testimony. We have some audio from that when we come back. Analysis about that as well. Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa, Donna Hoffman with us from the University of Northern Iowa. Won't you join us in our discussion this Politics Wednesday? 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Find us on Facebook or tweet us at IPR Talk. Back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News in just a moment. So nice to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's Politics Wednesday. Joining us, Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa, Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa. Join our discussion, 1-866-780-9100. And in just a moment, we're going to talk about Secretary of State Clinton's testimony before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. But before that, just within the last minutes, the House of Representatives has authorized a suspension of the nation's debt limit through mid-May. This delays a default in the government's obligations, which would have taken effect in February. The GOP-controlled House voted minutes ago, 285 to 144, comfortably passing this three-month extension on the government's borrowing authority. Donna Hoffman, can I turn to you to tell us why this move by the Republicans?
Well, I mean, I think maybe some people see it as a bit of a retreat in one sense, in that they're not going to push a default on that at this time. Now, this is not the only piece of the puzzle in the fiscal puzzle, if you will, because we have a number of things happening. You mentioned that, you know, the Treasury had projected that mid-February was when we were going to reach the debt limit. March 1st is the date in which the sequester that we kicked down the road from the first part of the fiscal debate around Christmas time would kick in. And then March 27th is when the continuing resolution under which the government's currently functioning runs out. And all of those things, they're different pieces of the same puzzle. And, you know, the kicking the and, you know, we should note that this is a suspension of the debt ceiling. It's not actually raising the debt ceiling, which is kind of an interesting way that they're dealing with this. And so
what difference does that make?
Well, when you raise the debt ceiling, you actually, you know, take a vote. You raise that to a particular statutory limit, you know, at whatever trillion or, you know, whatever they want to put it, set it at. This, as I understand it, would actually not do that, but it would suspend so that we would not default for those 3 months of this extension. And so the Treasury would continue to pay the bills and that kind of thing and be able to borrow. And so that is something that is a kind of an interesting way to take this issue, push it down the road just a little bit. It ensures that that's still an issue that we're still going to have to deal with at some point. And it also ensures that, you know, essentially it's wrapped up with these other things that pertain to the sequester and pertain to the fiscal year budget.
Tim Hagel, a core mantra of the GOP majority in the House has always been the debt ceiling must be matched by spending cuts of an equal or greater magnitude. And you're saying, do you see it as Donna does? This is just picking a fight that's a little further down the road rather than the fight that's coming up first along the path.
I think you really hit on the reason that they're doing it this way rather than just raising the limit at this point is because, again, they have said, well, look, we don't want to raise the limit without additional spending cuts. But, you know, effectively they are raising the limit, but they are, as Donna was saying, going to have this fight later on. I know a number of fiscal conservatives are very unhappy that this is happening, and even the lead into this half of the program, the person indicated that the House Republicans had punted on this particular issue. So there is some negative reaction to it. But on the other hand, it does give the House Republicans a little bit more time to come up with an alternative, a proposal to basically get their feet on the ground in terms of how they're going to approach this. If they had tried to force the issue right now, they're sort of on a losing streak in terms of being able to deal with this. They didn't come off in terms of the fiscal cliff negotiations that well and the election and all these sorts of things. And so that Obama was really on a roll. And so this gives them a little time to regroup, I think, both politically but also practically in terms of how to deal with this particular problem.
Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa, Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa. Let's move to some other breaking news that we've had today. Earlier today, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton telling the Senate Foreign Relations Committee that she took responsibility for not adequately protecting U.S. personnel in the September 11th attack on the U.S. diplomatic facility in Benghazi, Libya. It was an attack that resulted in the killing of Ambassador Chris Stevens. Also, three other Americans died in that attack. Defending the administration's immediate handling of the attack, Clinton clashed at times with Republicans this morning over the account of the administration that it gave in the initial days after September 11th. Here's an extended clip, a couple of minutes, an interesting exchange that Secretary of State Clinton had earlier today with Republican Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin.
I just want to say that, you know, people have accused Ambassador Rice and the administration of, you know, misleading Americans. I can say, trying to be in the middle of this and understanding what was going on, nothing could be further from the truth. Was information developing? Was the situation fluid? Would we reach conclusions later that weren't reached initially? And I appreciate
that. Madam Secretary, do you disagree with me that a simple phone call to those evacuees to determine what happened wouldn't have ascertained immediately that there was no protest? I mean, that was a piece of information that could have been easily obtained.
Well, but Senator,
within hours, if not days.
Senator, you know, when you're in these positions, the last thing you want to do is interfere with any other process
I realize that's a good excuse.
Number two, it's the fact. Number two, I would recommend highly you read both what the ARB said about it and the classified ARB, because even today there are questions being raised. Now, we have no doubt they were terrorists, they were militants, they attacked us, they killed our people. But what was going on and why they were doing what they were doing?
No.
We were
misled that there were supposedly protests and then something sprang out of that, an assault sprang out of that. And that was easily ascertained that was not the fact.
But the American
people could have known that within days, and they didn't know that.
With all due respect, the fact is we had 4 dead Americans. Was it because of a protest, or was it because of guys out for a walk one night who decided they'd go kill some Americans? What difference at this point does it make? It is our job to figure out what happened and do everything we can to prevent it from ever happening again, Senator. Now, honestly, I will do my best to answer your questions about this, but the fact is that people were trying in real time to get to the best information. The IC has a process, I understand, going with the other committees to explain how these talking points came out. But, you know, to be clear, it is, from my perspective, less important today, looking backwards, as to why these militants decided they did it than to find them and bring them to justice. And then maybe we'll figure out what was going on in the meantime.
Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, this morning before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, in a heated exchange with Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin. Donna Hoffman, I don't know how much your schedule allowed you to follow the testimony today, but we did play an extended clip there. What jumps out at you?
Well, I think this was always destined to be a pretty contentious hearing, given a lot of the rhetoric that had gone on before, certainly in the immediate aftermath of that attack. But then when you had Hillary Clinton, you know, have to postpone her testimony, we got into some weird territory there in terms of why that was being postponed and some with her health issues, et cetera. And so I think this was always going to be pretty contentious. And, that's really the only clip that that's all I've heard of the particular testimony. But she's going to go, you know, before the House and testify today as well. And, you know, this was something that before she left office, Congress wanted her to be able to do. And she said she wanted to be able to do. And so she's fulfilling that before she leaves the office.
Okay. River to River listeners, how are you reacting? Have you been watching, listening to that testimony of Secretary of State Hillary Clinton? 1-866-780-9100, River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Perhaps you'll want to tweet us at IPR Talk. Tim Hagel, are there still going to be lingering questions about Benghazi? Chiefly from Republicans after this testimony, you believe?
Oh, I think that's going to be undoubtedly true. I did have an opportunity to see the whole hearing, and this was sort of the rare instance of a flat-out confrontation. Senator McCain and Senator Rand Paul also were fairly direct in their questioning, too, and some of the other Republican senators to a lesser extent. And so they have continuing questions. They want to know what the timeline was. Who told Ambassador Rice to go out and talk about the video, which I don't think I heard the word video through the whole thing, which disappointed some folks. But Senator Johnson in that clip talked about the protest, which the assumption is that it was based on the video. That was their justification that was initially indicated. And I think that even in Hillary Clinton's clip there in her statement, that there's an inconsistency, that she says that it doesn't matter, but it does matter, because if you're trying to look at, or at least the argument of one side is that it does matter, because if you're trying to find out how to prevent this sort of thing in the future, you need to know why it was that it occurred in the first place. And so it's understandable her frustration there with Senator Johnson. But apparently, at least at this stage, the answers are not clear from what she's saying. There's still they're still learning as they're going along.
Donna Hoffman, how do you think this whole continuing episode may affect Hillary Clinton's possible hopes for 2016? And she's by far the most popular Democratic hopeful for 2016, even though she has not declared.
Well, I think, like Tim mentioned, you know, this is still a kind of a developing situation in terms of what we know and what we don't know. And, you know, it depends on what comes out of that. But certainly this could be, I mean, she's going out essentially on this note. You know, Kerry's confirmation hearings will begin later this week to fill that particular post. And so that may be, you know, the thing that, that people remember as she leaves her position as Secretary of State. And, you know, I really legitimately don't think she's decided yet as to whether she's going to run in 2016 or not. But certainly she has, you know, she has the time to think about it in the sense of, you know, she will be relinquishing her Secretary of State duties. And, you know, if she wants to start, you know, coming and hanging out in Iowa, then we'll have some inkling as to what's going on with her thinking.
Okay. Any implications for Senator John Kerry, soon to be, we assume, the Secretary of State?
Well, what's interesting about this is that because Hillary Clinton is leaving the office and she was in the mix, that the focus of the investigation, at least to a certain extent, will be gone. And so Kerry will come in and he can say, well, look, I wasn't here and we're still investigating. And so in some sense, that may make it difficult for the folks that want more information on this to actually get it, at least and find somebody responsible. Well, Hillary Clinton has said that she's responsible, although, you know, it's hard to say how she's taken that responsibility. But the bottom line is that she's going to be gone in a short time anyway, so it may not matter in that respect. And so we'll have to see what happens in terms of if there are Republicans that wish to continue this and if they're successful doing so.
James is joining us from Des Moines. He dialed 1-866-780-9100. James, a reaction to the testimony by Secretary of State Clinton?
Well, I think that she hit the nail on the head when she said it's more about apprehending and dealing with the terrorists who did the act. I would ask the rhetorical question, then, do we get to go back to when faulty information was given to General Colin Powell when he appeared before the United Nations asking for their resolution? Why do we always play the blame game when there are other things that are more important than just to find out who made the mistake?
James, thank you for that from Des Moines. Let's move right to Slater. Don is with us on the same topic. Don, what is your opinion?
Well, yes, sir. I'd just like to point out, I didn't hear a heated debate between Secretary Clinton and the senator. I heard a man asking very politely legitimate questions about this situation, and a super overly defensive Hillary Clinton yelling back at him.
Okay. Don, thank you for your view from Slater. You wanted to jump in here, Tim Hagel.
Yeah, as far as the first comment is concerned, this was something that at least a couple of the senators during the hearing mentioned and wanted to bring up the in fact, Senator Durbin from Illinois was the first one that I heard mention it, so basically saying, oh, well, what about the false information in terms of the, you know, search for weapons of mass destruction? And one of the things that, at least on my Twitter feed, I was following this, a few people on the other side of the political aisle jumped out and said, yes, of course, you're defending somebody in the guise of then-Senator Hillary Clinton, who actually voted for this, as did several other Democrats. So I'm not sure that it's kind of a non sequitur to bring that up, but it's certainly something that's understandable. As I said, at least two senators on the committee for Democrats did bring this up.
Mm-hmm. Donna, your reaction perhaps to what Don said on the phone?
You know, I think that, you know, it's one of those things that, again, having only heard, you know, just the clip that was played here, putting that into larger context is in terms of Hillary Clinton's defensiveness, I would want a little more information on that. But you know, again, people in these hearings in particular come at this for with political reasons. And so, you know, part of why this is being treated the way it is, there's that element of politics to it as well, which colors some of what's going on in the Senate and the House today.
Hillary Clinton's name, one of two being tossed about at this early stage. As you said, Donna, we'll see who comes traipsing, crisscrossing the state, and we'll know more who has their eyes on the White House for 2016. But in addition to Hillary Clinton's name, of course, Vice President Joe Biden going out of his way during inauguration ceremonies to seek out representatives from Iowa and New Hampshire, the two leadoff states in our nomination process, this fueling speculation that he may seek the presidency in 2016. Here is a little light end to our show today. Joe Biden misspeaking rather noticeably a few days ago at the Iowa State Society inaugural ball. Listen closely.
I'm proud to be president of the United States, but I am prouder to be Barack Obama. Obama's vice president.
Joe Biden there amid the howls of laughter and cheers at the Iowa State Inauguration Ball January 20th in Washington, D.C. Donna Hoffman, does this look like already a race between Clinton and Biden among the Democrats?
Well, you know, like I said, I'm not sure if Clinton has decided that yet, but I think Joe Biden has decided. And I think we will be seeing him in the state of Iowa because I think he's ready to, you know, take that on, at least at this point in time. Now, you know, there's a lot of time that passes between now and that.
Right.
When the campaign actually starts, it's kind of shocking that we're even talking about it at this point in some respects. But nevertheless, you know, I think Biden very seriously is looking at it. And I think he has it in the back of his mind that unless some, you know, things change, he's going to run.
Okay. I think Politico.com agreeing with you, Donna. Biden, this is a quote from Politico. Biden, according to a number of advisors and Democrats who have spoken with him in recent months, wants to run or at least be well positioned to run. If and when he decides to pull the trigger, Biden has expressed a clear sense of urgency, convinced the Democratic field will be defined quickly. And it might very well come down to a private chat with Hillary Clinton about who should finish what Barack Obama started. That quote from Politico.com. Tim Hagel, any further thoughts before we move on with one last item?
I think that's a good quote in the sense of the idea of finishing what Barack Obama started, because it would, particularly for Biden, that it would be seen as an extension of Obama's term in office, not unlike was the case for George Herbert Walker Bush following Reagan, that it was sort of seen as a third Reagan term, so to speak, and that would be the case for Biden. Hillary would probably have to strike out on her own to a greater extent, although, of course, and depending on what happens ultimately with Benghazi, whether how much she wants to be attached to the current administration or strike out on her own. But on the other hand, you've got other folks that may be interested too. I've talked to a couple media outlets from Maryland that are talking about O'Malley, and he's got some Iowa connections too. He was here during the working for Hart during the Iowa caucuses way back when, and you've got Governor Cuomo of New York. So there are other folks out there that are thinking about it too, I'm sure.
Age perhaps coming into that debate.
Yes.
74 years old, Joe Biden. I wonder if that would make him the oldest inaugurated president. Reagan was how old in his second term? I'm not sure.
I think I read this today, and I think that he would actually be a year older than Reagan was the second term Reagan was inaugurated. And so that would be a concern in terms of long term, that you always think, even though you're trying to get elected the first time, there's some concern about, well, could you get reelected for a second term? And there may be, as I say, activists that would be willing to look for somebody younger to, again, carry that policy, those policy positions of Obama forward, even if not somebody that's in the administration currently.
One last point for quick comment before we close this Politics Wednesday on River to River with Tim Hagel and Donna Hoffman, our guests today. 40 years after the Supreme Court legalized abortion in its Roe v. Wade decision, 7 out of 10 Americans support the rulings. That's according to a poll released earlier this week. The Wall Street Journal NBC poll found only 24% of Americans would overturn the decision legalizing abortion throughout the United States. The 70% level of support for the ruling, the highest since the poll began its tracking in 1989. Similarly, the 54% of Americans who believe abortion should be legal most or all of the time is at a record high. Reflections on Roe v. Wade 40 years later. Donna Hoffman.
Well, you know, I think there's been, you know, with the anniversary of Roe versus Wade, there's been renewed attention on this issue. In the scope of the election, I think you saw a renewed attention on this issue as well. And so, but one of the things to point out about, you know, this particular polling is that, you know, Americans do have kind of a nuanced opinion on this. At one end, you know, there's a very small minority that believe abortion should always be illegal. And at the same, you know, time, there's a minority of people that believe it should be legal no matter what. And in between there is where you have the bulk of the people, where there are, you know, exceptions for life and health of mother and various things. And so it really can be a very complicated issue and very nuanced issue. But nevertheless, having some solid data in terms of the level of support that it gets, I think, is somewhat reflective of both the anniversary, because it's been talked about a lot in the media, and also the way that it played out in the 2012 election.
A few seconds for your reaction. Roe versus Wade, 40 years after that decision, Tim Hagel.
Not too much more to say about it. Again, I agree with Donna that it's how what particular limitations or regulations are put in place in that sort of that middle group as to when it's allowed, when it's not allowed? I don't think we'll ever get to the point where it's an absolutist position.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Going in within the second term, your eyes are on what in the coming weeks, Tim Hagel?
Wow.
I caught you off guard.
Yeah, I guess you did on that one. I guess I'd probably say just what happens with some of the fiscal stuff that's coming up, the sequestration and all of that.
Okay, Donna Hoffman, anything else to add?
I'm waiting for the State of the Union address to see what kind of tone Obama takes. We'll see more specifics on some of the things that he hinted at in the inaugural address, and and also the fiscal things are still developing as we talked about.
And that State of the Union bound to be longer than 18 minutes, we would imagine. Otherwise, he would probably be making history there as well.
That would be true.
Donna Hoffman, Chair of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. Tim Hagel, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Thank you, Tim and Donna, for joining us.
Welcome.
Thanks, Ben.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from Allison Sullivan. Technical support from Dennis Reese. In Cedar Falls, we had help from Tony Daner. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. Our theme music, written and performed by the River Monks. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.